weaker signal. When it comes to altitude versus gain of an antenna, most of the time altitude wins. So even if it's the lower gain antenna up higher, I go for it. And a cleaner pattern, I go for it. And if you're mechanically smart enough, there's ways you can make the antenna. You can have your cake and eat it too. You can mount a sufficiently strong, bendable 5/8 wave antenna on the middle of the roof and let it bend over every time it hits a tree branch. That's a bunch of opinions, but that's the way I would do it. N1YDY, make sure you wait for the beeps. K2RIW in the tech net.
The other station that wanted to say something, go ahead. I want to ask you quickly, do you want this for repeater use or for suplex?
Any repeater use is how I use it mostly.
One comment, I'm a repeater owner. I think a quarter wave is the best way to go because you don't want to have, the higher the gain you have, the tighter the beamwidth. So if you're a mobile and you got a repeater, say on top of a mountain, you have an umbrella effect. And we have found out in the metropolitan area that quarter wave antennas actually work better than higher gain antennas. That's just my opinion. But a quarter wave in the center of the car, let's say on UHF to a good UHF repeater will give you 40, 50, 60 miles range. And on VHF maybe a little bit more. Back to you, Dick.
Who are you, Dick? So it looks like you've got an answer to what you're looking for on this one, Howie. I mean, Hank, as I see it, there's a high probability that the antenna in the center of the roof is the way to go. Cleaner pattern. When you've got an antenna on the fender, you've got the directional pattern, and as you're driving across various highways and roads and you're making turns, and the repeater is fading in and fading out because of that antenna pattern, that's going to be a pain. Whereas when the antenna is on the roof and you get the omnidirectional pattern, now if the signal happens to fade out, it's because you've gone into a valley and there's just no signal there. It's not due to your own antenna pattern. I think you see where we're going in this one now, Hank. N1YDY, K2LIW.
So we know, Drake. Yeah, I think I got an answer, and it's sort of what I expected, so I thank you all. Now, the only other question I would, as an add-on or addendum to that first one is, would it be in the very center of the roof, or could I put the antenna, with a 19-inch ground plane, it basically, so that it ends up slightly forward bias in the roof, or is it best to use the actual center of the roof, or can I get away with using, having a circular pattern that's long enough around the antenna that's appropriate for the wavelength?
I've used lots of mag mounts on the roofs of my automobiles. I always set it in the exact center. You don't have to supply any other material if the antenna is really designed to be, let's say it's a mag mount, it is designed to be mounted on a metal surface and you put it in the center of the roof, in my opinion you're going to get the best performance. I don't see any good reason for mounting it anywhere else except the center. Back to you, Hank.
The reason would just be it gives me the opportunity to mount another antenna on a different band, further back on the car. That's all I was thinking of.
So we know, Dick. I've got good news for you, Hank. There's nothing stopping mounting the two antennas side by side. Say, for instance, you've got an antenna on 2 meters and an antenna on 450, and you've got them only a couple of inches apart. At first you think one's going to interfere with the other. They do not see each other for the most part. An antenna only sees what resonates on its frequency. Any other thing is almost transparent. A couple of inches of separation will do it. You can mount them essentially both in the center. The slight exception to that is if you were running a kilowatt on 2 meters and a small amount of signal that will couple into a 450 antenna could possibly damage the front end, but you're not going to do that. Yeah, and by the way, when it comes to the amount of cross-coupling, it's an easy measurement you can make by transmitting into one antenna and putting a power meter on the other. You'll find out what the amount of coupling it is. Most mobile rigs are extremely rugged. They are known to be firing into antennas that are sometimes short-circuited, sometimes touching branches of trees, sometimes it's a mag mount that's folded over, sometimes it's upper strong signals transmitters nearby. They're extremely rugged, and you've got to do something pretty yucky in order to really kill it with another antenna nearby. So, although various people are going to give you flack on this one, I say you can mount them very close. I know people who have done it, and you'd be amazed how well it's going to work. Back to you, Hank. Wait for the beep. K2LIW. Okay.
Thanks very much. I got the opinions, and I heard N2EO and they're trying to jump in, so why don't you pick it up?
John, you're about to become the interlocutor, the net control, Casey Kapivi, and I'm not passing it over to you. I've got to go away. Bye-bye, you guys. See you next week. K2RW will be clear. John, you got it.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, and good luck. Have fun. All right, Rich, pick it up.
The B4, I have one comment.
Joe recognize first, Rich.
Okay, John, very good. And, Big 73, catch you next week. Station, who wants to mount the antenna? I didn't get the name of the call, but, you know, 30 years ago, I worked in a taxi cab company in Manhattan, and, running MOCOM 70s, I believe, in the radios, underdash radios and taxi cabs. And we had mobile antennas mounted in the center of the roof. These are VHF Motorola antennas. And what you're talking about, there were NMO mounts, they were screwing to an NMO mount, but they had some kind of a spring in there. I never really looked at it, but these antennas would spring every which way. And when the cab drivers came in, they didn't care. They would hit the garage door, the antenna would spring back, and usually there was no damage to the antenna. Copper or in addition, what Howie said, this was in Midtown Manhattan, near what's called Blackrock CBS. I don't know if it's still there. There was a garage across the street with taxi cabs. We had a shop in the taxi company. And, there were dead spots with some of the repeaters that were being used, and I experimented. I put a quarter wave antenna on one of the cabs, and the guy came back and said he was amazed. It actually worked better than the 5/8 wave VHF to get up on the high buildings in Midtown. So, Howie is right in that respect. Back to Net and Tulio.
Very good, Rich. Yes, my van, I had three antennas in a delta pattern within 2-3 inches of each other. Three antennas, it worked fine, and they were all quarter wave. Joe, pick it up, sir. Over to you. KC2WGB.
Thank you, John. I didn't have a conversation, so we'll wait for you to think I've got here quickly. I can still run putting multiple antennas on, wouldn't worry about one radio killing another radio. The only person I've ever seen do that was one guy, one AM, where he operated into one of these triplexers, and I had to warn him about these things. These things are ceramic in construction design, and if you drop them or jar them, you can cause the things to do bad things inside, like lose their coupling inside. You disrupt them inside internally. I don't know what he did the thing, but he ended up having an isolation of about 10 or 15 dB between one port to another port, and when he transferred into one port with, I think, on high beta UHF, he blew the receiver front end out of the other radio connected to one of the other ports. That's the only way I've ever seen anybody blow up one of these radios connected to the
Yeah, very good, Joe. By the way, the one that you heard where there was damage, how much power were they running, do you know? Was it like 30 watts?
25, 30 watts in UHF, I think was about its power level. It was definitely enough to snuff the front end of the other radio. I think the other radio is a high band or 1.2, one over, I think which radio it was, but I remember taking my instrumentation and doing an isolation test port. This is, well, here's what your problem is. It's like, you had a very unhappy face on it. Can't quite show the results.
Yeah, it's not fun replacing those front ends. A lot there. On my van, they were non-resonant antennas. They were three separate frequencies. And I measured very little coupling between the antennas, even though they were only 3 inches apart. But I was only, one radio was running 100 watts, the other one were 30 watt radios. But I never had a problem with it.
Hi, gentlemen, WD2HW. Thank you for a great tech tip.
Control star, how are you doing, gentlemen? WD4YY.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome, Howard. And join us again. Joe, I'll say 73 to you if you're leaving. And thanks for that info. And I think we take everybody. Look to Paul. WS2N. You're lurking about.
N3N. There you go, John. Yes, we're here. How you doing?
Oh, waiting to hear what news you have for us tonight. And what's NASA up to? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the Maven spacecraft going into orbit around Mars. That'll be on, next week. It'll be done before the TechNet, probably in the afternoon, September 21st. So that should be, that's the one that was launched about 10 months ago. The Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution spacecraft. It's going to study the upper atmosphere of the planet. And when it gets into its orbit, it's going to be a very high inclination. So it'll come down as low as maybe 60 miles into the atmosphere, just the upper atmosphere. And then the apogee is going to be much higher, maybe 10,000 miles out, it's high inclination. And not quite orbital, but not quite polar, but it will be close to it. So that's the Maven spacecraft, and then you, three days after that, you've got India launched a spacecraft, their first one to go into orbit around Mars. And then let's see how that thing works out, and that's an atmosphere type orbiter as well. So both are orbited. They won't be used for landing, of course. Maven could be used as a repeater for the spacecraft that are riding around, all the robots on the ground, if need be, but they get by with Mars Odyssey in orbit around Mars and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, as well as a backup for them. You have the Mars Express by the European Space Agency. So we'll see how this goes. The next big orbiter landing mission is going to be by the European Space Agency. They have an orbiting mission and a lander. And then followed after that, another 2 years, they're going to have another one going there with a rover. They're building a rover. It's going to be powered by a solar panel. So Mars is the place to be, a lot of things going on there. They have a six-wheeled lander that's going to be driving around on that planet in 2018, maybe probably 2019. Things are usually a little delayed. Then about a year after that, NASA will be back landing a spacecraft on Mars, another rover. Very similar to Curiosity, except the, you know, upgraded with all the electronic testers. And that one will have storage capability. It'll be drilling, every now and then it'll drill a core sample into the ground. Right now, Curiosity will drill into a rocket, but they'll collect the dust, and they'll analyze the dust, and the new rover will be able to do that. The new NASA rover will be able to do the same thing, but they'll have an additional capability of making core samples and storing them in containers, analyzing them a little bit, but also keeping them for future sample return missions. In other words, they have long-term plans of sending another spacecraft to Mars, landing somewhere near this new rover. Drop it. Okay, there's not really that much more. I just want to cover one thing. NASA is releasing some money, not much, you know, maybe $100,000 each, these very small, relatively small companies that are involved with launching spacecraft to near space. Let me put it that way. They're eventually going to have people paying customers, might quote tourists, going on these flights that will be suborbital flights, and different types that have been plugging along for years. One is almost on the going to be on a payroll, which is Virgin Galactic. They're probably not December, but maybe January or February. They might be able to make their first tourism flight. But there's other ones, you know, that are almost ready to go. Lynx, the Lynx spacecraft built by X-Corp, that might be able to probably go sometime in 2015. And then there's one that I just came across recently. You'll be able to pay only $75,000, but it's not, you don't get blasted into space. You can take a ride up in a balloon. What this company is doing, it's called Worldview Enterprise, that's the name of the company. You pay them $75,000, and you get like six people to get into this spacecraft, landing spacecraft-like vehicle. And so it's got a set of wheels on the bottom, and it's got landing skids on the bottom. And you get inside, and it takes you like probably 8, 9, 10 hours to eventually get to 120, maybe 140,000 feet in its helium balloon. And you're dangling it from it. You're in a pressurized vehicle, and you're sitting there, and you're eating food, chatting with everybody, looking out the window, and eventually you get to see the curvature of the Earth from that high altitude. And when you get up there, they release you. One goes flying away, and you go flying down in this aerodynamic spacecraft-like vehicle. And that would coast all the way back to the airport. My guess is they'll probably use the Spaceport America in New Mexico. Well, NASA's funding these little projects and, you know, helping them move things along. I definitely had to bring that one up. It's an interesting company. They've actually flown smaller modules up to the probably a year or so away from actually doing this. So you got different prices. You can pay around 200,000, a little bit more to Virgin Galactic to go on their six-person ride in a real rocket, suborbital. Or you could pay a little bit less, maybe $90,000, and take a ride in the Lynx, and that would be just pilot and you. That's it. Put on a spacesuit and take a ride I call it near space, but anything above 60 miles is considered space, so that's what they plan on doing. And again, you'll come back to a runway with that Lynx vehicle. And that's a mere ride, I think they said 90,000. Now, for 75,000, you can get into this, I'm going to call it a gondola run skids, and it's got this carousel type of thing. And you're really going to float all the way down to the ground on this carousel. It's guided because it is a carousel. It'll go in a forward direction. So that's an interesting concept. And, these are all, they got hardware, they've tested.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
One other flight I wanted to mention, now that I dropped it out, is a SpaceX has a cargo resupply mission. Their fourth one, it's actually their fifth trip to the International Space Station. They'll be doing that on September 20th. I guess that'll be Saturday, this coming Saturday. And it'll be a early morning flight to 16 in the morning. And they're bringing cargo up to the International Space Station. And unlike the previous couple of flights to the space station, they don't have landing legs on this mission, from what I understand. I'll have to get a close look at the spacecraft, the booster itself. But from what I read, this one does not have landing legs. Last two didn't have landing legs either, that went to the geosynchronous locations. That they were private launches, they weren't using the Dragon. They were actually putting telecommunication satellites to a geosynchronous orbit. When they do that, they need all the power they can, and they can't afford the power that it takes to bring these things back to the ocean on a vertical landing type of trajectory. But what happened with this one, I've been able to gather, is the last commercial flight that went up, they switched boosters. All the ones going to the space station are supposed to have these landing legs, and the ones that go to a geosynchronous orbit are not, for the reason I just mentioned. Apparently they switched the landing leg situation, but you could see on the last launch, they had the connections for the landing legs. So it's almost as if they took the landing legs off, just left the connections there, and hooked it up to the geosynchronous rocket, and put that into orbit. And then they're taking the one that was planned for that Asian 6 launch, and put that rocket on the Dragon for the cargo resupply mission. So looks like this one's not going to happen, and I wonder if it all has to do with the Falcon 9. About 3 weeks ago, that Falcon 9, a reusable one that they've been testing out in McGregor, Texas, that one blew up on them. I'm starting to wonder if that has something to do with that, and they just don't want to try it out until they work out all the bugs what's wrong on that flight. We'll have to see. That's pretty much it, John. I just wanted to go over those couple of that are going on. There's so much more happening with Rosetta, orbiting the comet, getting ready for its, it's got a spacecraft on board, that spacecraft that will land on that comet coming up in November, and a lot of other things. The Orion spacecraft will be launched this December. December 4th, they'll be testing that unmanned, launch it to 3,600 miles up, do a couple of orbits, and they'll bring it right back down at high speeds. They want to see how the thermal shields work on the spacecraft, and of course a lot of other equipment they have on board the spacecraft. They have to test out the avionics, the computers, and the service module they have attached to it. They want to see how everything works and everything's ready, including the escape system that they're using, the polar escape system built by Orbital Science. It's going to be attached to the front of this Orion spacecraft, and they want to test that. That will be blasted away after they go into orbit. So that would give me interesting that happened December 4th. Back to you, John. KC22 WGB WS2M. Any questions?
KC2 WGB. Yes, I have two basically. Now, first is the mission discipline for the craft that's going to land on 2018 or 2019. What is the purpose of that mission? What will it be required to do, if you know?
Well, the 2020 rover, that'll be the NASA rover. And if it's delayed, of course, it'll be 2021 or so before it lands. It will always take about 8 to 10 months to get there. And that's the one similar to Curiosity. That will have the nuclear power, the RTG, the radioisotope thermal electric generator attached to it. Actually, the same model that Curiosity has. And that's the one with upgraded equipment that will actually be testing for, it can actually test for life. That particular rover, they come across with, anything that's, like any kind of a molecule, bacteria or virus or whatever, this thing would be able to detect it. And so will the other one, this other rover that you mentioned that's going in, that's going to Mars in 2018, that's by the European Space Agency. I think we have, one or two pieces of test equipment that are involved with that. NASA, has put onto that spacecraft. But, that's also a search for a life type of spacecraft. They'll have drills, they want to drill into the ground and test for everything. And that's going to be launched from Kazakhstan, that's a Russian proton rocket that will put that thing up to Mars. That has a lander that will go down with the rover, and that lander will operate only for a short period of time on battery, but the rover will drive off. They'll drive that as long as they can on solar panels. That's the European Space Agency version of a rover. So that's pretty much it. John, back to you.
Very good, Paul. Now, will it be landing basically in the same area where we've landed already, or are they going to a total new area, if you know?
No, they'll pick different areas. If you look at all the landers that have gone up there so far. They're all scattered around Mars, for instance. Spirit and Opportunity. They put one on one side of the planet and the other one on the complete other side of the planet. Voyager 1 and Voyager, Viking 1 and Viking 2. Back in 76, they put one on one side and one on the other. And they try to get information from a diversified, you know, Mars. You know, what's it like here? What's it like there? The Phoenix spacecraft, that was a lander. It wasn't a rover. NASA sent up years ago. That went to the most northern portion of the planet that they could get to. And that's the one that dug down. They found ice and everything. You know, that was, they had an arm that dug into the, that dug a trench into the ground. And that was solar powered. And it lasted probably about 8 months. They knew that was going to quit because the second Mars winter came along. They got it covered up with frost, you know, carbon dioxide ice, dry ice, you know. Just, that was the end of that spacecraft, but they knew that was going to happen. So they'll definitely pick different areas, I guess. The rovers will probably, you know, be somewhat near the equator. That's where the other ones are. It's, you know, it's better for communication purposes and all that. And it's always a fight between the scientists and the engineers. The engineers want to keep the rovers safe. They want to be able to communicate with them all the time. On the northern hemisphere, it's not as easy. If something was landed near the pole, you know, you don't have the almost constant relay capability that you have, you know, when you're close to the pole due to the orbit of Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and also the other two I mentioned before, Odyssey and Mars Express by the European Space Agency. Back to you, John.
Yeah, Paul, those engineers are funny guys. They don't like you playing with their instruments that they create. Okay, my next question is, you mentioned another craft that's going to be landing, I think you said 2021, I believe, which is going to take core samples, and evidently it's going to store them. You know, it'll analyze, and then it's going to store them. And then the following craft that lands is going to retrieve them, is what I understood from what you said. Is that what's going to happen? And do you know anything about how that transfer is going to take place? That sounds like a new, something new that's never been done before. Back to you, Paul.
I know, even so, you know, on all the rovers, they have all these fancy test equipment. The scientists would like nothing more than to actually have samples returned. The sample return mission has always been on the drawing board. It's not on the tax payroll. It's not being funded yet. But that's what you're interested in. They'll drill these things out. They'll test them a little bit on the surface of Mars. But then they're going to store them in these canisters, retrievable canisters, so that in the future, okay, now we have enough money, we're going to send another space, you know, one where, you know, they'll send as many spacecraft as they can, whatever they can be funded. But, you know, if they got enough money for what they want to do, they'd like to send a space, another one there, and drive right up to this rover, and, you know, get a hold of whatever's in their containment, maybe 5-10 years of work, who knows. Use an arm, put it into a, you know, into a launch vehicle. You know, they'll have that all set up. You know, this thing's gonna have the capability of launching itself back to space, and off it goes. You know, probably meet up with another craft in orbit. Dock, and then
they've never taken off the drawer.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's one they never took off the drawing board. Back to you, John.
Well, I, for one, I'm glad they haven't, because that sounds like an adventure. And, wow, interesting stuff. I never knew that was a plan that they had. So, I know they've always been looking to get things back, but I thought that would be a special mission and a vehicle by itself. But that sounds like a good idea. This thing can explore for whatever it wants for many years. They'll be able to select samples and then get them back to us. Good stuff. Okay, if there's anybody out there that has any questions for Paul, now is the time. This is KC2WGB, the TechNet.
Yeah, and John, they're getting accurate in landing these spacecraft. You know, I mean, they put this one exactly where they wanted it. Spirit and Opportunity, they came very close to where they originally wanted to put those spacecraft. And I remember, it must have been 6 months ago, John, you asked, when is Curiosity going to be at the foothills of Mount Sharp? That was its destination. Now it's been driving around for over 2 years now, 2 Augusts ago. We watched Curiosity land on Mars with the sky crane and all that they had. And sure enough, they finally reached the foothills of Mount Sharp. So that answers your question, but it must have been 6 months ago you asked that. Back to you, John.
Yes, you're about right. I was wondering, so it's there now at the base. Now, does this thing, do they have a map where they're going to try to make an ascent on this and try to go as far up it as they can? What's the plan after they get there? Well, they're there now. Well, what's the following plan?
It took them a little over 2 years, really, to get to Curiosity. I mean, they stopped on the way and did tests, drove with the rocks and all of that, and tested all the equipment on board, make sure everything worked, confirmed that, you know, that the environment that where they had landed, Gale Crater, was wet at one time, had the capability of supporting life. Found this out right away. Now they spent the last 2 years driving, and now they finally got here. Spent, I don't know, I think three or four miles or something to get here. And now what they plan on doing is looking at the outcrop, the bottom parts of this mountain, and they'll spend probably a year or two, I guess, doing that, drilling into rocks, and going up a little bit at a time. You know, next highest level, drill into another rock, test that. That's the goal. They're going to be really into science now instead of driving all over the place, which is good because they had a lot of problems with those wheels. They're all bent up. Like a lot of holes from all the rocks, driving over sharp rocks. And because of that, they changed their route. Even now, you know, they have to drive a lot just to get to their first location, wherever they're going to drill a rock, you know, their first rock. So the, they're helped by the maps that Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter makes. You know, they have something called a high rise on a Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That thing looks down. And if you have like a stool in your room that you're sitting in, a little chair, and you put it on the planet, this thing would see that chair. It would come up in a couple of pixels. And so it looks down every now and then when it gets in the area of Curiosity, and it examines the details. Give the people that are programming Curiosity a good idea of
which way to go. They've actually changed the course completely because of all these rocks, these small rocks that were digging into the wheels, so they went over more softer ground. They also found ground that was very soft, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and they backed out of that. They said, you know, the wheels were starting to slip. They could tell from the amperage changes on each wheel has a, like a, so you get an amp reading from each of the six wheels, and they can, you know, they can see that one or two wheels are slipping, so it's no good. Back out of that, and then they'll change their location at the future map, you know. I mean, they don't have GPS, but they got that thing up above, and that tells them really where to go. Back to you, John.
Yeah, and they're doing all of this thousands of miles away and have to wait for the radio command. So marvelous. What a great team we have here with NASA. You know, by the way, you mentioned the core drilling, and I know, like me, you watch a lot of these science shows and stuff. There was one on the other night where they were talking about the pre-dynastic Egypt, where they found quartz and granite rock extremely hard with holes, core holes made in them, some of them 100 millimeters in diameter. And I'm wondering, I don't know if Dick had seen that program, I don't know if you've seen it, but it makes you wonder. That's at least 8,000 years ago. Wonder if they had rovers here. Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
I didn't see that. I wonder if that was on, say, PBS. They usually run that again. Sometimes they have that free on demand. But, 100 millimeters, what you're looking at. Well, that would be all right. What, 10 centimeters? Four inch hole. Wow. Now, the next rover that will go up there will drill these core samples. They look like, I mean, they're small core samples. They look like the diameter of a pencil from what I was looking at. Not much more than probably 3/8 or probably 3/8 of an inch diameter. My guess, on those things. You know, you don't have a big, powerful drill, but whatever they're going to use is going to be able to do that. You won't see 4-inch holes on Mars. You know, once people get up there, we'll be able to put some heavy-duty equipment on a planet, then you can do something like that. But 4-inch diameter hole 8,000 years ago. I gotta see that one. Was that Channel 13?
I'll try to look that up for you, Paul. If I have a copy of it, or if it's available, I'll email it to you. A very interesting program. It's about an hour long, but a lot of interesting things about Egypt that I think I really gets into it. But I'll see if I can get that for you and send it over to you.
Okay, real good, WSON. By the way, I sent Dick and you the last week's topic, map the surface, the spacecraft that's gonna check out the water, whether or not it's gonna be ice or moisture. You might find a couple of things interesting in that. I don't know if you got that, John, but I sent Dick one as well. He asked a lot of questions about that thing. And that should go up at the end of this year, December. That's that large, and anybody that's listening, that was that large 20-foot diameter spinning antenna, spinning radar type antenna. It's going to unfurl, you know, like a gigantic unfurling umbrella type of system, and then start spinning at 14 revolutions per minute, and taking pictures of the Earth. We're trying to figure out about the percentage of ice and moisture that's in the top 2 inches of the surface. Back to you, John.
Yes, Paul, I did get that article. I didn't get a chance to read it. It's quite a lot of reading there. I didn't realize there was that much information on that craft, but I do have it set aside to read. That was very good, and I thank you for that. But, you know, I remember when we used to drill 4-inch cores and 6-inch cores with the big Hilties, and I'm thinking, how could we even get a Hiltie up to Mars? It weighs as much as the spacecraft. Good stuff.
Yeah, we used to go right through concrete with the coal boring machines. Different sizes, you know, everything from small bits to everything from 1-inch bits all the way up to, we've done 6 and 8-inch bits, you know, they make them bigger than that, but we used to attach it to concrete with a shield, drill the shield and bolt this thing down, and pour tons of water into it. You have to have a water source. Sometimes you'd have a portable container, you know, for water if you didn't have a water source. And you would make these concrete holes, and it would go right through steel. They had diamond tips on these core boring machines. So, but, I don't know, that thing drew a lot of amperage. It was electric. And I don't think... curiosity, the other one is going to have that that capability. You'd probably need a solar bomb up there to produce that kind of electricity. Back to you, John.
Yeah, that'd be a long extension cord, that's for sure. But yeah, I remember some of those cores you're talking about. We'd take them out and those damn cores would be 100-150 pounds. Oh, big stuff. Okay, again, anybody out there has a question for Paul in the space report here on the TechNet, KC2WGB.
Hi.
And Paul, what are the restrictions to the Russian rockets that have been widely used by Americans? Do they have any replacement for it? Talking about rocket engines.
Yeah, that's the RS-180s that we've been using. They had hundreds of these things left over from Russia. Originally from the N, right, the N rocket that they had. That was their moon rocket. They were going to put in, I don't know how many of these things, like 100 rockets to get themselves to the moon. They believed in a lot of little rockets attached together, and that was going to get them to the moon. They had so many of these left over, and they used some, and they sold us a lot. You know, I don't know the number, just call it a couple of hundred. And then our companies took them and rebuilt them, make them work better. And now we have the capability to make our own. We don't, you know, we have the rights, you know, no problem with patents or copyrights, whatever it is. So there's still plenty more left in storage that we have. And that's only pretty much used for the Atlas rockets. And the Global Finds are using them too. They still have some in stock, so
power can build back what they are, the reusable rockets that we use on the space shuttle. We still have some of those left over. And in fact, we're making them about 25% more powerful as we speak. So like the first launch in 2017, we'll be using those rockets. That has nothing to do with Russia. So we'll be all right. Back to you, Weston.
President Chickman, I wonder how it was the concept, the original concept, the Russian concept. Because you said we don't have a problem with the copyright or copyright and longer. So is it like much more upgraded rocket free of any obligation towards Russia? And is it because the patent rights already expired? Would it put in something here?
I'm not sure how the international patent rights things work. You know, I know in America, well, we have 17 years for that. I don't know what happens. You have these border deals. I know which whatever ones we have, we're allowed to redo them, you know, improve them, and in fact duplicate them if they want. They like the design. They were a very well built rocket. Even so, the N1 rocket failed. They launched two of them. Both of them failed, and they were going to be their rocket that was going to bring a cosmonaut to the moon. The rockets themselves didn't fail. The apparently the aerodynamics of the spacecraft, or the booster did, or maybe the electronics, you know, that guided it. Who knows? The guidance system. I don't know what made those rockets fail. They kept them secret. I mean, they launched these things back in the 70s. Maybe even the, probably 69 or something. They kept it a secret. We didn't know about it until, what, the 1980s or something. But the rockets themselves, each, like I said, they had, I don't know how many rockets on the bottom of this thing. It looked like between the first stage, second, third, and second, third stage, they probably had 70 rockets. That's pretty much all I know about that, Wesley. Back to you.
Patent rights in the U.S. are usually for 20 years from the date of the first apply for the patent subject to the payment of a appropriate maintenance fees for the utility of the patent. However, design patents are for 14 years from the date the patent was granted. And that was the patents for the maintenance, they don't have maintenance fees. But anyhow, I hope we are free of Russian involvement there. It's a time. So much. Anyhow, back to John.
KG2WGB. Very good, Wes. Good to hear you in there. Well, supposedly we've got enough of these rockets to get us through. Now, Dick had mentioned a week or 2 weeks ago that NASA was thinking about reinitiating building our own spacecraft again. Have you heard any word on that? I believe he asked you that, if I'm not mistaken.
Somebody had asked him that a while back, and we came to the conclusion that he was talking about the XS-1 project that DARPA is involved with. That's a defense agency researcher group, and usually they they have all these companies getting involved, and after a product is developed, somewhat, you know, pretty much functional, it usually becomes part of the military, and you never hear of it again. It becomes top secret. But in this case, it doesn't. This is all, you know, they're developing it. They want private companies to be involved with the XS1 project. And that would be, you know, X space plane instead of spacecraft 1. And that's what the S is for. And they released it to, you know, maybe 4 different companies. I'm on key here. And what they plan on doing is having these as the boosters, that the boosters will be suborbital and probably with wings on it. And for instance, you take a company like Masson. Masson is they're using these vertical launch rockets and vertical landing rockets. For years they've been experimenting with a small company, and they only have 20 people working for them. I went over this last week, and they're one of the companies that NASA chose. They plan on putting wings on one of their launch vehicles, and ideally they would take maybe 300 pounds to up to maybe 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of a payload, and take this payload, put it into the back of this booster. You might have like a little door that opens up, similar to what the space shuttle used to do. They have the cargo bay doors open, and you would launch this to near space. And once you get up to speed, the cargo door would open up. The spacecraft would come out, say it weighs 500 pounds, and you know, attached to it is a little booster, and it will blast it into orbit. And then this booster thing, this XS1, would return to Earth and land on a runway. Not land on a runway, but land vertically. What they plan on doing is maybe have it land on a runway. Right now, they don't really care. They want these companies to develop this system for that, you know, for this one company, NASA's purpose. You could have wings on it, and you could bring it, fly it right back to where it took off from, rise up, and then come back and land